भद्रं कर्णे विश्वनुयामते वाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षभिर्यचत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तारक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. All right, we are going to start on the Vaitatya Prakarana today. Vaitatya really means mithya. It means that which is false. Do you want a book? You okay? What's the page? Edward?
61.
Vaitatya means that which is false, that which is not real, the Vaitatya Prakarana. And so after having done the first Prakarana, the Agama Prakarana, Prakarana means like the chapter, the section. So the Agama means the Shruti. So Gaudapada, in his first chapter, he calls it the Agama Prakarana because the topic of the first chapter is really the 12 verses of the Mandukya Upanishad. And so it's the Karika is an unfoldment of those Upanishad verses. Now, he, having done that, wants to try to logically establish what the Upanishad has revealed to be true. Right? So remember, I was in the other class talking about in the whole sampradaya, the whole teaching methodology. And it's true also for something to be true. For something to be true, there's three factors that should come together for you. One is, in reference to the Upanishad Pramana, first of all, I'm going to put it like this. First of all, what you're positing to be true should be able to be known through a pramana, a means of knowledge. And here the pramana that we're using is the Upanishad pramana. Okay. But there are many pramanas. We use pramanas also, perception and inference and postulation. There's six major pramanas. But all of the major pramanas in what means of knowledge in one sense can be divided into perception and inference because the others can all kind of be packed into those two. So in the Bauda, for instance, they'll accept perception and inference, but postulation and all the other ones also can be associated with either one of those two. So for us, it's for the Vedanta, it's perception and inference, and all of the other ones too, like postulation and non-cognition and comparison. And also shabda. Shabda means the Vedanta as a means of knowledge. So you need to have, for something to be true, there has to be a pramana. First of all, a means of knowledge that you have to base what you're saying on. It can't just come out of your mind fanciful. Yeah. It also should have anubhava. It should be true to your experience. Usually we put this other one first, yukti. It should be logical. Logics should support it. Right? So you need a pramana you need a means of knowledge in order to have the experience in the first place. You need a means of knowledge. Like, for instance, if I'm blind, if I don't have eyes, then the any type of anubhava or logic based upon the sense of sight is not going to be available to me. See what I mean? I need to have a pramana give me the initial knowledge, which then has to be supported by yukti and by anubhava experience. And so here, accepting the Upanishad as a means of knowledge, we've now analyzed what the Upanishad has to say. So now the question is, does that what the Upanishad have to say, can it be supported logically? Can what it has to say, taking the what it has to say as what we call the pratignya, pratignya means the initial statement of any type of logical syllogism, is always the initial statement. Can that initial statement be supported through logic, through inference, for instance? And so that's one of the things that we have to see. Can Advaita say if the Upanishad is establishes from its own standpoint as a pramana non-duality? Can that non-duality which it proposes be supported logically and experientially? That's the task. And so in this Mandukya Karika. So how he's going to approach this is, first of all, looking at this world, the dream state and the waking state, and asking, is this duality that we experience in the world real? Is it satyam? Is in itself real? Because if it is real, then Advaita, non-duality, is not real. And so his first task is to establish that all of our experience, everything that we objectify, in fact, he's going to go on and on about this actually, but what we say is drishya. What is drishya? Drishya means whatever can be objectified, right? That itself is mithya, by the very fact that it can be objectified. And so we're going to see the logical progression of all of this. Remember, I'm going to have to say a lot of things right now, so, and I can only say one word at a time, so no problem. but just to add some things here to make it clear, if I see something is objectifiable, that it is seen. Drishya actually means it's a potential participle, that which is seen, that which is able to be seen. Sometimes we say that which is objectifiable is drishya. Anything that is objectifiable needs to be objectified by someone. So when you say something is objectified, there's a subject-object relationship implied there. Right? And so now the question is, and that's our situation here. Here we are in the world, and we can say in this world that we are in, that it is, this world is real. I am real, this world is real. Why is it real? Well, because I see it. Here it is. I experience it through my sense organs. If I say I see it, I might as well say I experience this world through my five sense organs. Right? It is seen by me. It is known by me. And we can go on and on from that point, but we start there. This world is experienced by me. It is seen by me. And then I can go on from there saying, and being seen by me, I have some things to say about it. For instance, I see this world, I experience it, and I can't make it go away in this sense. Like if I ask you to experience, to imagine a pot or imagine a tree, I have the power to make that tree go away.
Right.
I imagine it, and I can give birth to the tree. I can sustain the tree in my mind, and I can negate the tree also. So I would say the tree is not real, right? Because I can make it go away just like that. So the tree is imaginary. It's not real. But I can't do that for this world that is perceived. Okay? And so I would say this perceived world is real, but the subjective world is not real. Okay? And that's how we basically operate. We'll say my imagination is just imagination. My thoughts are just thoughts. They're subjective. I don't give any type of reality to them. If I want to call them nitya, apparent, that all works well for me. But it doesn't, I'm not able to cross over this border between my subjective experience, which I can negate as mitya and as apparent. It's hard for me to give that same level of reality to this world that I perceive, because there are differences, right? There are differences in the experience. But then what the Shruti here, what Gaudapada wants to establish, that actually it does seem like that at first blush, but actually the world that I experience through my sense organs has no more reality than the world that I subjectively experience. We could say only that the world that I objectively experience has a greater, longer lasting reality than the world that I subjectively experience. But to Gaudapada, and from the standpoint of the Mandukya Upanishad, you have to remember that we've already been through the Upanishad. From Gaudapada, what he started doing was just using the word swapna, which means dream, to include the waking state and the dream state. He just collapsed them both together. And the reason he did that is that from the standpoint of the self, which cannot be considered mithya. The self cannot be considered mithya because it's not drishya, it's not objectifiable, it's not subject to time and space, right? Because there's no subject-object differentiation from the standpoint of the self. So it's not going to be an object in the creation. You're not objectifiable. You don't have any parts. And so there's no coming and going because there's no duality from the standpoint of just awareness itself. From awareness itself, because not objectifiable, it's not taking place in the subject-object duality. You know? Whereas whatever is taking place within the world is subject to the subject-object duality, is subject to duality in that it's infinitely divisible, everything in the creation is coming into being and going out of being, and that doesn't really make any difference whether that those facts are true both for the waking state and for the dream state. Mm-hmm. That they depend on subject-object, know or known differentiation, that they exist with both exist within time and space, both are objectifiable, everything in them is coming into being and going out of being, so that's the same for the waking state and the dream state. But it's different for the self, for the Atma, or for the fourth state, for the fourth pada. So for this fourth pada, the fourth state, the Atma, it is differentiated as satyam, that which is free from time and space, free from change, free from objectification, free from duality. It is differentiating the self, that me, from both the waking and the dream, which are from its standpoint the same order of reality. They're the same because time and they both exist within time and space. Like waking and dream both exist within time and space. Both have subject-object differentiation. Both are in a continual process of change. So he made the distinction, Gaudapada made this distinction in terms of what he called agrahanam, tetva agrahanam, and anyatagrahanam. I don't know if you remember these terms. He called the deep sleep state, so remember the Upanishad, waking state, dream state, deep sleep state. The deep sleep state as tetva agrahanam. Agrahanam means a non-perception. In deep sleep, there is no perception. It's a negates agrahanam. Tetva agrahanam means there's no knowledge of the truth. There's no perception, but what's relevant here is in that deep sleep, there's no self-knowledge. There's total agrahanam. There's no perception. In the waking and the dream state, there's what we call anyata. Grahanam. There's perception of something other than what it is. Anyata means in another way. You're seeing it in another way. You're seeing reality in another way. You're seeing the Atma, yourself, in another way. Because in the dream state, you become the dream character. In the waking state, you become the waker, right? Whereas, in fact, you're neither the dreamer or the waker, or we would say even more clearly, the self, you are the self of the dreamer, you are the self of the dreamer, who is the self of the waker, who is the self of the deep sleeper, who from its own standpoint is free of all three. That's who you are. See, there's a very important logic here. If I say, it's called this anvaya vyatireka logic, that I have to be, if I'm trying to figure out who I really am, I have to be the one who remains, not the one that goes. Right? If I have any experience that I have, any experience, doesn't matter what it is, even say, just take the waking state, any experience that I have, if that experience can leave and I still remain, that experience is not me. My being, that experience may depend upon me, which is why I can identify with it. Any experience I have, I can totally identify with it. And as a samsari, I do. If I'm very sad, then I am very sad. I am sad. I have become sad. I am sadness itself. I've become that. But when the sadness goes away and, say, a great shanti comes, then I can say something like, I was so sad. I was so sad, and now I'm so happy, thank goodness. And in my mind, I'll think, the me who was so sad has now become happy. But actually, I could never have been sad if the sad state goes away and is replaced by the happy state. Because these two emotions are conflicting. When the one is, the other is not. But I am the self of both. The one who is sad is now the one who is happy, is now the one who is agitated, is now the one who is sleeping, is now the one who is dreaming, is now the one who is awake. The one who was young, the one who was a teenager, the one who was in her 20s, the one who was in her 30s, etc., etc., etc. You know, that is me. And so the anvaya vyatireka logic goes like this. When this is, that is. When this is not, that still is. It's just an incredibly important relationship, because understanding this relationship, if this is the satya-mitya relationship, understanding this relationship, I am free. This is what it is. The satya-mitya. Satya-mitya is this. When this is, like when the waking state is, right, I am. This waking state that I am conscious of the world and I am a conscious being, this waking state depends on me. Without me, the conscious being, there is no knownness of this waking state. The waking state requires conscious being. Okay? And I am the conscious being which it requires. So here this waking state is, I am. I am the conscious being because of which the waking state is known. Now, even if I say that to you, even as pure samsari, if I say you are the conscious being because of whom the waking state is known, you say yes, because here I am with my sense organs, and without me, I can't have an experience of this. But as you do the Mandukya Upanishad and the Vedanta in general, what you realize is that, well, this body, mind, sense organs, and these sense organs and mind that are responsible for perceiving this world, being a waker in this world, are really themselves known. Right? You're aware of your body, you're aware of your sense organs, you're aware of the thoughts in your mind, and you're aware of the world. The whole thing is a big package, and the whole thing, in fact, shines in your being. We take ourselves to be the subject in the world, aware of the objects that we experience, but as you do this drisha, see your seeing differentiation, you realize, well, wait a minute, everything that I thought belonged to awareness is actually part of the world. And the awareness me is not one of these objects, but is the one because of whom all experience shines. That's what I realize. And then say, if you're stuck in this waking state, you can do so much vichara, so much analysis of your own experience just in here. We're looking now at the whole waking state that's going to be displaced by the dream state, but just in the waking state itself, every experience that you have is, just like the whole waking state itself, every experience that you have is illumined by me. Because of me, it is known. That's the reality. Thought after thought after thought, because of me, it is known. I'm the conscious being which this, all of these thoughts depend upon to be known. All of the emotions, all of my emotions, from the most sublime to the most dark, all of them depend upon me to be known. But the viveka is this. They are only here when they're here. I'm always here. The me never goes. There's no fluctuation at all in me. The whole panorama of the experience of the world is passing through, and I'm remaining. There's nothing I can do about it. I can't make it different than that, but I need to recognize it. When you recognize it, then you can try to make it different. First, you've got to recognize it, and your freedom comes in the recognition that you cannot do one thing about that. You cannot make it different. You can't make yourself come and go. You can't change the quality of your being by a thought or by an emotion. The emotions have their own quality. They have dark qualities and they have light qualities. But you don't. You're the substratum. You're the substrate reality of all of that. Yourself is never changing at all. And if it was, let's say you have a sorrowful emotion and now you have become sorrowful. And now what happens when the emotion passes? You're gone. If you're that emotion, when that emotion passes, you're gone, and now you become another person. The next one that comes. But you're not another person. That's why you can say, you have what's called, I'll get to that in a minute. You can say, I am the one who was sad, and I am the one who is now happy. No. It's called a pratibhijna. It's a technical term, but what it means is pratibhijna. Is that in my experience from day to day to day, going through waking, dream, deep sleep, going through all the experiences I have, I am always there to as the thread. I am the thread that relates all of those experiences. The pratibhijna means the one who I can say to you, the one who is here right now, I'm the one who did this yesterday and the day before. The thought I'm having this thought now, but I had this thought a minute ago. That's pratibhijna, where I have a memory of my experiences, and all of my experiences are related to me. Right? The experiences aren't really related to each other. They're related to me. In fact, the experiences contradict each other often. But I'm present to all of them. And that's true if I go the big, wide strokes, when I go from waking state to dream state to deep sleep state. These states negate each other. When the one is the other, absolutely is not. When you're having a dream, from your standpoint, I mean, when you're having a dream, you have a universe that you're engaged in. And that universe is not the same as the waking state. This we know, but as we'll see when we go through these verses, Gaudapada doesn't take this for granted. He's going to prove to you that the dream is mithya, as though you don't know that. Mm-hmm. We know it, but we don't think about it, the repercussions of it, that the dream is mithya. But what we have to end up seeing is not only the dream is mithya, the waking state is mithya. The waking state is mithya because it depends upon my being, the satchit, the conscious being, for its being. It's because of that, it's mithya. The dream is mithya because it depends upon me, my being, for its being. The causal condition is mithya also, the deep sleep, because all it also depends upon my being for its being. It has no being of its own. And in the deep sleep, there's not even any activity taking place. It's all in causal condition. So when we say something, let's make this very clear. When we say something is vaitatya, which is what the word he's using for mithya, false, this is what false means, or what mithya means. Mithya or false is not a thing in itself. Mithya is not a thing. Neither if you say something is false, that's not a thing either. That's talking about the order of reality a thing enjoys. Right? And so if I see a snake on a rope, I'll say that snake is false. False is not a synonym for snake. It's pointing to the order of reality of the snake. You see? If I said the rope is real, real is not a synonym for rope. It's the order of reality of the rope in reference to the snake. And so when I say a term like mithya, mithya is not a synonym to maya. It's not a synonym to the nature of the creation or the dream state. It's the order of reality that the creation, that the waking state enjoys, or the dream state enjoys, or the snake enjoys. It means, what mithya means is that it has this this very unusual situation, whatever is, has this order of reality, in that you can't say that it's real, because it doesn't last in all three periods of time. It comes into appearance and it goes out. It has a beginning and an end. And if it has a beginning and an end, experientially, that means it's bordered by non-existence. Because it comes into, actually comes into being and goes out of being. So you can't say that it's real. If it's not real on the end, either side, it's not going to be real in the middle either. But at the same time, we experience it. And so you can't say it doesn't exist. So you can't say it's satyam. Satyam, again, is an order of reality, and it means it simply is. It doesn't have a beginning and an end. It's free from time. It actually exists. It's not bordered by non-existence. It is. That's what is real. Anything that comes from non-existence and goes into non-existence has non-existence in the beginning. It can't be considered as real, but you're experiencing it. And while it is there, it is. That's mithya. While it is there, it is. But it doesn't have the isness. Satyam has the isness. Satyam has the being. Mithya depends totally on what actually is for its being, because by the very fact of it being mithya, it has no being. That's what makes it mithya. Mithya, something that is mithya, depends totally on what is satyam for its existence. The snake depends totally on the rope for its existence. Without the rope, no snake. The snake, the rope doesn't depend on the snake. So the rope is, in this relative example, the rope is not mithya. The snake is mithya. The rope doesn't even notice the snake. The snake has no being. The only thing that's really there is rope. See that? Clay pot is the other one. Clay pot. All that is really there is pot, is clay. That's what's there. That's the satyam. The pot is there. It's practical. We use it. But it is mithya. That's its order of reality. Because it isn't independent. Mithya is not independent. And so, with mithya, the relationship between satyam and mithya, in terms of our experience here, is like this. When this is, that is. When this is not, that still is. Satyam is what is not negated. When I say something like, when this is, that is, in my mind I think, well, this and that are the same. Like if I say, you know, when this body is, I am. But for that to be really true, I would have to say, and when I am, this body is. Right? The one is the other. But what if I can say, when I am, this body is, and, well, say like this to make the language right. This body is when I am. This body exists when I exist. But when this body doesn't exist, then I don't exist. That means I'm this body. When this body is, I am. When this body dies, I die. That's something that means that there's one thing here. There's not a satya mitya. Satya mitya is when this body is, I am. And when this body dies, I still am. That's satya mitya. So now satya mitya here, when this universe is, I am. Whole universe. When the whole Maya, everything that exists within time and space, the whole Maya creation, when this whole infinite creation is, I am. When this whole infinite creation is gone, is resolved, I still am. That's the reality of Advaita. That is Advaita. That this reality of this duality that we experience has no being separate from one Satchitananda, the conscious being that I am. That is Advaita. It is no statement about the experience of this world, the infinite expression of duality. It's not saying that's not there. It's saying it's mitya. Not that it's not there. Dream is there. This world is there. The heaven worlds are there. The hell worlds are there. All the multidimensional reality is all, it's all here. And it is all mitya. It is vaitatya. That vaitatya means mitya. Gaudapada is using vaitatya. All of this is vaitatya. This body, the waker is vaitatya. The dreamer is vaitatya. The deep sleeper is vaitatya. Your thoughts are vaitatya. Your emotions are vaitatya. The ahankara is vaitatya. All of this is mitya. Vaitatya is mitya. That's its order of reality. It's not correct to say that it's an illusion or a delusion, you know, or a fantasy or any of these type of words that sometimes maya is and mitya are so this is just all an illusion. It's not appropriate. It's not talking about illusion. It's talking about an order of reality. You know, when we use a word like illusion or delusion, we're talking about some subjective illusion that I'm mental state that I'm having, and then we're taking this illusory illusion mental state or delusion, a mental state, and then we're saying the whole world is a mental state, is like a delusion. It's not about being a delusion. It's an order of reality that we, as jivas, this body, mind, sense organs, we are all part of that order of reality. And that order of reality that we call mitya must, by its very nature, be dependent upon something else. Because what makes it mitya is that you can't find any being here as you analyze it. You can't find any substance. You can't find a thing here. The Buddhists are perfect at this. Try to analyze something here, you find an infinite display of interconnectedness, but you cannot find a thing. There is nothing. Everything is infinitely divisible, right? And everything is coming into being and going out of being. So you can talk about the interrelationship of all things to make this into one infinite projection, which we call the creation. The interrelationship of all things is really what we call dharma, or the infinite order of this one expression that we call Ishvara. This one manifestation of Maya, infinite Maya, is what we call Ishvara. And Ishvara, we can say everything on every dimension of duality is interconnected. There's nothing that is outside of that infinite manifestation. But that infinite manifestation is mitya. Mitya doesn't mean, oh, it's only mitya. I hear this, oh, it's only mitya. You're saying that the creation is no good. You're saying the creation doesn't really count, or it's no good because it's only mitya. There's no only mitya. Mitya is an order of reality. You have to look at it as whole, this whole thing. There is one Brahman, one conscious being, which is me. There's only one me. Why do I say me? It's because that's the word we use in Vyavahara. In this empirical reality, the word that we use to indicate our self-experience is me. Because why don't I say I? Well, I is distant me lands on me. Right? I is more conceptual. But when you say me, it's a direct object. Right? And so the word me lands on, just grammatically I'm saying, it lands on the self, it lands here. Right? I is going out this way, I am doing that, I am going. So me lands here, that's why I say that. Just as a word, the word me lands on the conscious being that I am. The conscious being that I am is not objectifiable. If I were objectifiable, I become the object. Then who's the subject? Mm-hmm. And so your I, me, whatever word you want, is always landing on me, the subject. The one who is there present as the self of every experience I have. Without exception. I am the one who is there. I'm the constant. And so everything else, except for this simple me, is objectifiable. Therefore, coming into and out of existence, it's all part of the movement of duality, from this my thoughts, my emotions, my memories, even the I thought, my mind, my sense organs, my body, my perceptions. Absolutely everything belongs to this world, this world of experience that we call mithya. In terms of the order of reality it enjoys, because none of it has any existence of its own, because it's all coming into existence and going out of existence. But listen to the language. All of it is coming into existence and going out of existence. Existence is not coming into existence and going out of existence. That existence is me. So now I can say, all experience, without exception, no exceptions, all experience is coming into me and going out of me. Because I am the being. All experience is coming into being and going out of being. Into existence, going out of existence. What do I mean? It's coming into me and going out of me. The me isn't coming and going. Nor is the me dependent on anything that's coming and going. Which means this me is not dependent on any of these bodies. The me that I am is not dependent on this body, or mind, or sense organs, and you all have to say the same thing. All of these things are coming and going. And so this me that makes me is really the one me that is the self, which is the very self of the whole manifest creation. This me is the satyam to all this huge mithya. And that's why we say all of this is Ishvara. Because all of this is me. All of this is a conscious being. Because it enjoys the same satyam that everything else within this mithya world enjoys. It enjoys the same one satyam that is non-objectifiable, that is just simply conscious being. So that means this conscious being, you know, is the substance, the being of everything mithya, so of this whole creation, which makes this whole creation a conscious being. That's what we call Ishvara. And now, what is the Mahavakya? What is the whole Upanishad? Is that this conscious being, which is Ishvara, is me. Because there's only one me. So what is so beautiful about that is when you're from the standpoint of your mind and body, you know, from the standpoint of the body-mind, however you want to say, the mind enjoys me. I am itself. So now what we can say? The mind enjoys, is always present to Ishvara, to the self which is Ishvara. When we say the self, which is Ishvara, because Ishvara has a self. When we say Ishvara, we bring in Maya, the whole Maya Upadi. But the whole Maya Upadi, Maya is Mithya. It has no being apart from Brahman, the self, which is one infinite being, which is me. So this being that is me is Ishvara. Because Ishvara isn't anything but conscious being with the Maya Upadi, right? With the Maya. Maya is Mithya. And so the very being that is me is the being which is Ishvara. What does that mean? That this whole mithya creation, this whole maya, that enjoys me, my being, right, which is Ishvara, means that even when I think of myself, I'm only thinking of Ishvara. And that's why for the Jivan Mukta, for the Jnani, it's not... And the Karma Yoga Buddhi resolves... The Karma Yoga Buddhi is that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, where I take everything as prasada from Bhagavan, from the Lord. That Karma Yoga Buddhi for the adhikari, for the student who is studying to really gain this knowledge, that Karma Yoga Buddhi resolves into there is only Ishvara. All of this is Ishvara. I am Ishvara. This body is Ishvara. This world is Ishvara. There is only Ishvara. It's not that, and Swamiji was, I remember at the first course, we were at a big satsang in the temple. And Swamiji asked to some of the Hindu brahmacharis there, what is the difference, do you think, between Hinduism and other religions? Something, I can't remember quite, but he said something like that. But Anantanand Rambachan, who's written all these wonderful books that I always give students, he raised his hand and stood up and he said, many other religions will say there is one God, but the Hindu will say there is only God. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. There's only God. It's not that there's one God. There's only God. And so for what happens for as you gain nishta in this knowledge, there is me, but that me is Ishvara. The me that I am is Ishvara. So instead of saying, I am Ishvara, because then you'll have that Dehatma Buddhi, you identify with the body, and say, I am Ishvara, that sounds so egotistical. No? But what if you say, Ishvara is me? Ishvara is the self in all beings. You can say, I am the self in all beings. All through the Bhagavad Gita, they use that. I'm the self in all beings. The Sarva Bhutatma. I'm the self in all beings. This self that I am is the self in all beings. The self that I am is the self of Ishvara. Where Ishvara is my very self. That's a little bit more. If I say, the Lord is my very self. That's the truth of it all. And as that becomes more and more understood, there is no dvaita between your being and Ishvara. So the mind, this mithya, the mithya mind, body, sense, organs, always rests in Ishvara. So it's Ishvara internal and external. This is Ishvara and this is Ishvara. And so the mind has a total refuge, right? The refuge is an internal refuge and an external refuge, because everything has resolved into Ishvara. Now, in order to help gain not just the Shravana, because in the first part of this Upanishad, that Gaudapada did the Shravana. What the Shravana is the unfolding of the Upanishad, so that the meaning of the Upanishad is clear. Now it's necessary to do the Shravana and Manana. Manana is what is going to get rid of any type of doubts about what the Upanishad has to say, using logic, yukti and anubhava, logic and experience. Because the mind will say, yeah, but why couldn't it be like this? That's Manana. Shravana is, well, what does the Upanishad, what is it really saying? What is it really saying? What does it really mean there? So it's the Shravana is what the teacher is teaching, but the inquiry at this part, the teacher does all of it, and so does the student. But the teacher is going to do Shravana. This is revealing, unfolding what the Upanishad is saying, so that you see what the Upanishad is saying. This is what it says. There's no doubt. It's Shravana. But the Manana, which is now what Gaudapada is going to be doing, is more like Why couldn't it be this way? The Upanishad says it's Advaita, non-dual. Well, I don't see, why couldn't there be many selves?
Mm.
Why wouldn't that also work? That might be better. You know, so, or why there's no self.
Mm.
I don't see that there's any self. The more inquiry we do into the creation, there is no self. There is no reality here. Which is absolutely true when you're using sense perception and inference to analyze the nature of this creation. You actually cannot find anything here. But you can find an infinite interdependency and causal connection. But you can't find a thing. Even if you analyze the jiva, the body, mind, sense organs, and say, where do you see any self there? There's no self there. There's just a conglomerate of stuff stuck together. It can settle and grows, but there's no self. And the Vedanta would completely agree. In the sense that if you're analyzing mitya, mitya will disappear on you. It just disappears on you. You cannot get to the end of it. You can't find anything. It goes into an infinite regress. You can't find anything here at all. But it will, accepting that, it will reveal it to be mitya, meaning that there is something here, but what is here is not objectifiable. There is a self, but it's not a bunch of little selves. It's not a bunch of little body selves. There's one me, this me that you experience as me. That is you. It is you. It's not that it isn't you. It is you. But there's only one of you. But the you that you are, this me, is the me of the whole creation. It is the self of the whole creation. So this manana now has to be done in order to give what we call jnana nishta. Nishta means firmness, clarity, so that your mind has nowhere else to go. These questions like, why can't it be like that, and why can't it be like that? Those questions are all resolved. And in fact, every single one has to be resolved. And that's the whole teaching sampradaya. That's why the teacher and the commentaries try to bring up every conceivable doubt and answer all of those doubts. And a lot of times that I remember somebody often having this experience where Swamiji would finally bring up one doubt when that was lingering in my mind. I'd be so happy. there it is, you know. And then there would be another doubt somewhere, and then that would. And in satsang, I would always be asking. But that's part of the teaching methodology, that all of these doubts have to surface and then be worked through. And they are worked through. The teacher will help you work through, and your own manana will help you work through. But in the end, it has to resolve in your mind. And by resolving in your mind means that you yourself see it without any doubt. It's not a belief where the teacher says, well, this is how it is, so just that's how it is, okay? This is how it is. Here's the logic. This is how it is. And then you're supposed to say, okay, well, okay, here's the logic. This is how it is. That's a belief. That's not what we're talking about. That's just a belief. This is like the catechism. This is the logic for the catechism. This is what we're supposed to believe. That's not it at all. You have to see it in your mind. And all of the pieces have to fit together in your mind so that for you, there's not another possibility. You see it, and there's not another possibility. If there's another possibility, then that's the next thing to be worked on. What is so, why in India we spend so much time learning Sanskrit and all this is so that learning at least have enough familiarity with Sanskrit so that you can go through all of these commentaries, you know, or if they're taught in English, then that's fine also, but you have to be able to go through all of these commentaries. Because all of the doubts that you could never even think of are all dealt with. You know, and then as a doubt will come up, you go, oh, yeah, what about that? And then you have to think through that, you know. And your students, everybody's different. They all come up with their own own doubts, you know. One person, I mean, say one person has a doubt. When they bring that doubt up, other people may not have had that doubt, but now they will. Because you brought the doubt up, so that then now that's something to be worked through. But that process of working through is how one gains nishta. That's why they use the example for nishta. As you know, they use an example of a post, like a fence post, put into a post hole. And how when you first put the post into the post hole, it's very wobbly. And then you have to pound more dirt into it, still wobbly. You pound more dirt into it, still wobbly, until so much dirt has been pounded into it is that it's firm. So that represents that whole process of doubt. I have this doubt, and then I have this doubt, and then I have this doubt. But as these doubts, this manana is done, as these doubts become clear in your own mind, where you see it. It doesn't matter if anybody else sees it. That doesn't matter. It's that you see it, then that everything starts falling into place until there aren't any doubts. There comes a time when the question will come, but the answer comes with it. And I don't mean like a rote answer, I mean you see it. Mm. The question comes, you see it. But there comes a time when the question no longer comes because you see it. You know? First you have the question, and you ask, and you teacher explains, or whoever explains, and you either see it or you don't. I had questions that I asked for the longest time. and again, in many, many different ways. Many different ways, because something was missing. I didn't get it. And then I got it. And then I would still, probably the question would, just trying to remember the whole process of all of this, the question would come again, but now I had it. And so then I could resolve it myself as the question would come. And then the question would come and the answer would come. And then the question no longer came. Because I was clear. There's a process. What we call knowledge. And so you can't be afraid of putting it out there, putting the questions out there. That's what it is. That's what we have to do. It's a good thing. You know? And that's why some people feel that, we used to always say this, and this is everybody feels this way in one way or another. They don't want to ask their questions because you think your question is stupid or you should have realized this by now. It isn't true. For one thing, when you ask a question, somebody else is going to be relieved. That's one thing. That's always so. But the other thing that I know probably all of you have noticed this, is that at the very, just when you start out learning, you'll ask questions. But, you know, 5 years later, or 6 years later, or on all the way on through, you can be asking the same question, but it's a different question. Because that question now is coming into a different context in your mind.
Different platform.
Yeah, it's a different platform. It has different meaning now. And even though the same words can be used to answer the question, it still means something different because the context is so much more. And that's what happens as you go on learning. Swamiji had used the example, it's like if you look at gaining this knowledge as painting a picture, where first the picture is painted in just broad strokes, you know, like a big swath of blue for the sky and some green down here like that. And then slowly some little more detail is put in. And then a little more detail. And more detail until the detail is so much that the painting is almost three-dimensional. It's so much. I used to remember thinking when Swamiji and I was going through the course in India, thinking, just be overwhelmed that he was yet again going into another level of detail. That I thought the detail was so much already. But then he, it's like peeling off another layer and going in even further, you know. And that used to just totally overwhelm me, the amount of detail that is being given here, and what a freedom it gives to the mind. We think that this knowledge is beyond the mind. The self is the mind, you know. There's nothing beyond the mind. The mind is the one that has the problem. The mind is the one that has the curiosity. The mind is the one that wants to understand and wants to know, you know. And so why shouldn't it know? If it's there to be known, why shouldn't it know? It's a tremendous freedom for the mind to be able to know, to understand. Even to understand the body, mind, sense organs' place in mithya, in this world. To understand its own mithyatva, and the world's mithyatva, but then to understand all of the laws and how all of this works and what it's like, what it means to be a jiva in this Ishwara's creation, and to understand all of that. Because as it understands, it relaxes. It likes to know. It likes to have knowledge. You know? And that knowledge, if the knowledge is pramana-based, if your logic can't shake it, and if it resonates with your experience, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And the thing is that if it is really knowledge, and knowledge means it's true to reality, then the knowledge just keeps getting deeper and more confirmed. Your all of your experience, you know, confirms it, substantiates it, gives you nishta. Your life gives you the nishta, because the knowledge isn't away from your life, and so all of your experiences are just drumming it in continually, and giving you all of that adhikaritvam, all of the viveka, all of the vairagya, all of the places where your raga, dveshas, and all of that. It all just, you know, it gets taken care of by the way that the universe supports your knowledge. It confirms it. So it's such a beautiful thing that it even exists. I remember when I first had been with Swamiji for a little while, I was totally overwhelmed with the thought that there is such a thing as this, that there is knowledge, that a guru is real, that actually exists in the creation, and it's not just a made-up idea.
Or a fairy tale,
you know, like, you know, like a wonderful fairy tale, but that it actually exists in reality, that there is, that knowledge exists in reality, that liberation is actually something that exists, is such an incredibly amazing thing. And I remember when I first realized that actually was true, it was so unbelievable, and at the same time, it's the only way that it could be for this universe to not be like a horror story. Mm-hmm. For this universe to be something benign and beautiful, this would have to be there, but if it weren't there, it would be something hard to cope with in some ways. So that's the introduction to chapter 2. Let's take a break. Take a breath. Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamidachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
I have just a little question. You know, this word logic, I almost find it a frightful word, because the way I encountered logic was that you had to be a genius to solve these complicated, nuanced problems. But that is not the kind of logic we're working with here.
No.
So could you maybe make a comment on that?
I'd say for us, the whole teaching methodology is taking you logically step by step to actually seeing. It's not something like a syllogism that's away from your own experience. So logic for us is used to take you step by step. If this is true, then this is true. Then this is true. Like when we do the Anvayavyatireka, that's not hard, right?
No.
It's natural. It's easy. Because it's being applied to your experience. And so then you have to say, when some sort of logic like that is unfolded to you, you have to say, yeah, well, that's right. Because it's talking about experience, what you're experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And so you don't feel like you're taking a logic class.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the truth is logical.
So
logic won't get you there, but the truth is logical. You know. You can't... The logic that you learn in school, or the logic that is contained within just sense perception, can't get you outside of the box of sense perception.
Yeah.
But the Upanishad gives you a vision that is not really gained through your sense perception. It's its own pramana. It's a revealed methodology. It's a revealed teaching. So that gives you a vision, and then with that vision, then any amount of logic will support it. But it itself won't get you there. You can do a lot of neti-neti, you know, not this, not this, not this. But to get that positive assertion that there is one Advaita, you need more than that. You can negate the whole world, you know, but then you'll just be there with the negated world. There's actually a lot more to be said about this, but just briefly. The thing that is that you can't get to just on your own is that this creation is Ishwara. You can do neti-neti, not this, not this, not this, and get to some sort of an abiding, stable self. You don't know quite what to do with it. But you can get there. But you don't know what to do with it or where to place it.
Mm-hmm.
But where you cannot get to is that this creation is Ishwara, is one infinite self. From the standpoint of the creation, that it's one infinite conscious being. And that takes some, I don't have the energy to unfold.
So this is a different kind of logic, then. It's not a scholarly logic, particularly.
Well, you can say it's not an academic logic, but, you know, what is scholarly and academic does not have to be a dirty word. We can be in teaching Vedanta, there's a lot of logic involved, there's a lot of study involved, a lot of understanding involved. It's not just coming one time and getting
the package.
Or some magic, it's not that. There's a lot of study and understanding and clarity, and all of these things are involved, but the thing is you don't feel like you're studying a book, you know, or trying to learn taking an academic course. It isn't like that, because it's all about you. And so all of the logic that's being used and all of the unfoldment, it's all about you. And so we're, as a mumukshu, we're soaking it in, because because this is exactly what we want to know. That's what makes a mumukshu. This is, when you're a mumukshu, this is what you need to know, what you must know. And so when it's being explained, explain this logic, right? When it's being explained, you know, and unfolded, what's being explained and unfolded is what you want to understand, what you want to know. And so it's not like going to a course and studying logical syllogisms and all of that for their own sake. It's that these teaching methodologies are being used to hold up a mirror. You had Viditatmananda said one time in the car, he said, you know, nobody ever gets tired of looking in a mirror. And Vedanta is the deepest mirror you can have. You know? And Swamiji says long, he's kind of unfolding all this, he'll give long laughing stories about how much everybody likes to look at themselves. And, you know, like if you go into the bathroom, you always check yourself out. If you're walking, he used this example, like if you're walking down, you know, going to an airport, you're walking toward your plane. Sometimes you're down these long, long hallways, when these long hallways, and one side of the hallway, well, the whole thing will be a mirror. You know? And so the whole way that you're walking down, you'd be, and that's just looking at this upadhi. But when a mirror is held up to you, to the depth of your being, and you're held up in a way, you know, like a mirror where you're seeing, you just cannot get tired of that.
Speaking of doubts and repetitive questions.
Yeah.
So at one point you were saying, so this whole creation, I think, if I got it right, resolved into Ishvara, something like that. And so...
Or I recognize this whole... Go ahead. Recognize this whole creation as Ishvara.
Okay. And so I'm still having issues with Ishvara, and it came up in a recent class. And like, what is the thing that it resolves into? And actually, you know, you've referred to Ishvara as intelligent, and also as a hymn, and that's where I get kind of thrown off. And we had a discussion about devatas in another class. It seems like there's a way that a lot of people personalize Ishvara, or have, like, there's some kind of personality there or something. And I'm uncomfortable with that, and there's the whole history of the Western upbringing and all. But I am comfortable with there's not that there's intelligence there, because I don't see that there is. If there's a giant brain somewhere running.
Yeah, intelligence, if we use that word, then there's a lot of other words that we have to use in order to neutralize the concept of the word intelligence as we use it in the world. So.
Okay.
If you just say conscious being, or if you say, if you look at this whole creation as manifest knowledge, that's one term Swamiji is using now that I think works well. Manifest knowledge means, like if I ask you to think of a meadow, that knowledge that was in unmanifest condition becomes manifest. And so if you think of the whole creation as a manifest infinite knowledge, then when we say intelligence, it just means there, it's not inert. Just like your mind has intelligence in it. But if we use intelligence like consciousness, infinite consciousness, infinite, like what would infinite intelligence mean? It would mean that everything is known, right? Everything is understood. If there's infinite intelligence, it means that the whole manifest order of the creation is known. There's nothing unknown.
But aren't there a lot of unknowns out there? I mean,
Well, for an individual, but not for Ishvara.
But, so how? Who is Ishvara that he or she or...
Ishvara isn't...
All this stuff?
It's not like that. If you take... just awareness, okay, plus Maya, which is responsible for the projection or the manifestation of the whole creation. That's what Ishvara is. Just awareness with that Maya, the Maya which is cyclical. Maybe you haven't been through all of this.
I have, but just didn't get it.
Yeah. No, and maybe we haven't, certain things, because you're relatively new, there's certain things that we may not have gone through in a lot of depth, but so for now. If we take just awareness with the whole Maya, that's Ishvara. The Maya is what's responsible for the projection of the entire creation.
Satyam plus Mithya.
Yeah, but Satyam is an order of reality. Right, so Satyam refers to Brahman, to consciousness. Mithya refers to the order of reality of Maya.
Okay, they're adjectives. So the nouns that they describe are Brahman and...
And Maya.
And Maya, okay.
Brahman, which is Atma, the Atma, which is Brahman. The Atma, the self, is Brahman. The self is infinite.
Okay.
Is infinite conscious being.
So that's where the consciousness aspect comes from.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, well, let me finish with Michael.
Okay.
So that the awareness that I am, but this Atma, this conscious being that I am, that we call the Atma, what we realize as teaching goes on, that this Atma really is the self of all beings. It is the same self in all beings. And this self is what we call is Brahman. Brahman means the self of Ishvara, the self of the whole, all of Maya. So Brahman, this self which is infinite, with Maya, is what we call Ishvara.
And so that's kind of circular.
How?
You just defined the Brahman as the self of Ishvara, and then Ishvara is Brahman plus Maya.
Yeah. What that means is, if I take Brahman with Maya, then Maya is cyclical, so it manifests as the whole creation, everything that exists within duality, and goes back into unmanifest condition, then manifest, unmanifest, from beginningless time. Okay? So, the self, when the self is manifest, then that self, that Maya, I mean, when the Maya is manifest, it's Mithya. That's its order of reality. That Maya has for its being Brahman, right? Because Brahman is the Satyam. Brahman is what is the conscious being which the Maya enjoys, and so that Brahman is the self. And so if I say Brahman, Ishvara has a self, we talk like that because if we use the whole teaching is really you, the individual, you are Brahman. Or another way of saying it, you, this body, mind, sense organs, this person here, you know, is Ishvara. If I say this body, mind, sense organs is Ishvara, how could that be? How could I say this individual is the Lord? It's only in this sense that the self of this individual, the Atma, that Atma is the self of Ishvara, the Lord. There's only one self. And so to understand, if I were to say, make a statement like the jiva is Ishvara, to make that make any sense at all, I would have to unfold the nature, the truth of the jiva, to realize that the self of the jiva is the Atma, and then the truth of Ishvara, to realize that the truth of Ishvara is Brahman, and then understand that the Atma is Brahman. That the self, another way to say it, that the self of the individual is infinite and is the self of the whole creation.
I think I had a misunderstanding about something that this just clarified, which is I tend to think that saying that I am Ishvara, I tend to think of that as, well, I am this jiva here is a part, or at least the body, mind, sense organs is a part of the whole creation, not separate from it. But it's not the whole thing. But this is not what you're saying at all.
No.
You're saying that the self of this body, mind, sense organs is the Atma, which is Brahman, and that is also the self of Ishvara.
Yes, that this Atma is infinite. and that this Atma is Brahman. If I say it's infinite, it means this Atma is Brahman. And that this Atma, which is Brahman, is the self of Ishvara. This body is a part of Ishvara, like a wave is a part of the ocean. Right? A wave is a part of the ocean. A wave's not the ocean, but it belongs to the ocean. It's part of the ocean. Like that, this body is a part of the creation. Part and parcel of the creation. But the self of this body is the self of the creation.
I guess, okay, and then the next step, this makes sense. That makes sense in a sense of being.
Yeah, being, right.
But knowledge, manifest knowledge, that seems like a whole other step that I'm not getting.
Manifest knowledge is what we call the Maya that manifests as this creation. And you, as a jiva, are part of that manifest knowledge. Like you're an individual. If the manifest knowledge is a way of talking about this infinite creation, it's an infinite manifestation of knowledge. Part of that infinite manifestation of knowledge is you, your body, mind, sense organs. Why they say manifest, using the word manifest knowledge, is because it helps you to understand this entire creation as a conscious being. Because, like, if I ask you now to have an imagination of a meadow, right? I just did this, but do it again. You have an imagination of a meadow with people walking in the meadow. That is a manifestation of meadow knowledge. And in that meadow knowledge, there are many people and animals and trees, etc. But the thing is, why do we say now it's a manifestation of knowledge? Because that whole thing, that whole meadow, has for its being awareness. So the whole meadow is known. Right? So if I say, well, think of a meadow, think of an ocean, you know, think of a city. Whatever you think of, it's a manifestation of whatever knowledge has been there in the unconscious, in unmanifest condition, now comes into manifestation with all of its diversity, and that whole world is known. That's why we use the dream also, because that dream is coming from unmanifest condition into manifest condition, and now that whole dream is being experienced, right? So the creation is like that, but on a cosmic, on a total level. From unmanifest condition, it comes into manifest condition. But the whole thing is known. That's why we say it's Ishvara.
It's right? Known in the sense that there's consciousness.
From its own standpoint, it's like your mind is known because there's consciousness, right? So the whole universe is known because there's consciousness. Means the whole universe reflects consciousness like your mind reflects consciousness. It's not inert.
So knowledge is being used in a different way than the ordinary.
Yes, it's being used as infinite manifestation of knowledge. But that's why if you hold these, juxtapose these two, this example with the nature of the creation. If I say, imagine a meadow. Now your mind has taken the form of the meadow, and there can be a lot going on in that meadow. Say it's a vibrant meadow with animals and people walking around in it. It's a whole little story, meadow story. That whole thing, meadow, is known. And all of the jivas walking around in the meadow are having their own little relationships, and maybe you're identified with one of them, and etc. So there's a meadow world going on there. But the whole meadow itself is like a manifest knowledge. It's a thought modification. The whole thing is known. Right? It enjoys consciousness. Right? It's your thought. Like your thought, you have to, I'm talking not in a tricky way. I'm just saying every thought you have enjoys consciousness. It is, every thought is known. Every imagination is known. We're saying the entire creation is known. That, but not by the jiva. The jiva, the individuals are part of the entire creation. Just like if you have in a dream, you have a dream and there are little people walking around in the dream, characters in the dream. They don't have knowledge of the whole dream. Only you as the Ishvara of the dream or is that whole dream known? The characters in the dream all have limited knowledge. They're looking out through their sense organs and engaging with each other. They have limited knowledge. But you, as the Ishwara of the dream, the whole thing is known. So here we are like characters in the dream. We have limited knowledge. But the whole universe of every multidimensional universe, that whole universe is known. That's what we call Ishwara. It's consciousness plus Maya. The Maya manifests as the whole infinite creation. And that whole creation, like an infinite vritti, is known.
Maybe it's a semantic, but when you say that whole thing is known, there's an implication that there's a knower.
Well, that implication is
built into the language.
Yeah, I know, but you know what? That has to go for you also. In as you gain knowledge just from the standpoint of the jiva, you think that there is a knower is because you identify consciousness with the upadi. You identify conscious being with your mind and your sense organs to make there be knowership. But in reality, there is only, in terms of the truth of the experience, everything is known. That's why I do this little riff with you all the time, but I know it takes a long time to really get it, and you'll keep getting it in different ways. But like when I say like this, the wall is known, okay? The wall is known. Just experience it. Say, yes, okay, your bookcase. The wall is known. The intervening space is known. This body is known. My sense organs are known. My thoughts are known. The mind is known. I am known. The me is known. Conscious being is known. Every experience is known. Now, we create knowership by identifying me with the upadi, the mind, you know, and then identifying myself with the consciousness in the mind and differentiating that from the objects of consciousness. Because actually the mind, whatever the vritti is, the whole thing is known. The self is known. The sense organs are known. The body is known. There's nothing right now that is not known. Knownness is consciousness.
Does that consciousness, known is known, does it?
It never changes.
It doesn't change. It's changeless.
Does anything change if you use the phrase there is knowing?
The only thing you can say, knowing has a verbal sense.
But known has an object sense.
Known has a completed sense. Is known is a passive sense. Mm-hmm. If you say knowing, then to me, mm-hmm. and you can use your language to make clear what you mean. Okay. Mm-hmm. But if you say knowing, that for me makes, it has an active sense, like I am knowing something. It brings up the knower. Whereas consciousness is not knowing anything. It just is, it is a completed state of knownness. And that knownness, take that as exact synonym of consciousness. So then I could say, instead of this is known, this is known, this is known, I could say like painting consciousness, space consciousness, body consciousness.
Is there an Atma consciousness? I mean,
Atma,
it knows itself.
Atma consciousness. If you say
itself is known.
It's self-evident.
Brahman is known.
It's self-evident. So if you don't like, is known can also be confusing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to just use Atma is consciousness, not consciousness of something.
That
something there in order for that thing to be known. Atma's not doing anything to know it.
And consciousness has a sense of known.
Yes, it is known, it's self-evident. So instead of saying is known, we say it is self-evident, self-luminous, self-shining. We use this word, these words, so that you don't think that it has to be known by an outside source, by another pramana. You know,
there's no pramana.
It doesn't require a pramana. It doesn't, because it's self-shining. Let's stop. I just remember we're going to do something else tonight. Let's stop now. And
we hit the finish line?
Hit the finish line. It's time to stop now, everybody.
And we're all winners.
No, we'll take it up next week. This is a good discussion. I'm not trying to cut it short, but I am cutting it short a little bit.